we're very lucky today to have Steve Fuller here to speak to us. I met Steve a few months ago at Virginia Tech at a science technology studies conference I was attending. And I was actually sort of infiltrating that conference as a media technology and society person. But I had a chance to hear Steve's keynote address, and it was about sort of making STS a more applied discipline to speak to not just to academics, but people working in science. And it was very moving, and I was just like, wow, we've got to get him here to talk to us. And later on that same day, I overheard Steve talking to others. Well, you know, I'm going to be at U of I later on to talk about it. And I'm like, hey, you know, could we borrow you for a day? You know, either on the front end or the back end, you know, come up to Evanston and speak with us. And sure. So the deal was done, and so we're lucky enough to have Steve here with us. Steve is an amazing and prolific scholar. A visit to his webpage leaves a poor graduate student awed by his productivity. Even more stunning is his world-spanning travel schedule, his work within STS, especially with respect to social epistemology, and yet he still finds time to teach and supervise graduate students. Welcome, Steve.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me, and I'm sorry I'm only going to be here for 24 hours. The topic that I want to address today is one that I think is very important and certainly very near and dear to my heart, is the public intellectual an endangered species? Now, the public intellectual happens to be the topic of my most recent book, which came out in Britain a couple of months ago now. It's called The Intellectual, and it's actually modeled on Machiavelli's The Prince. Okay, so for the aspiring intellectual, as it were, what are the sorts of things you ought to know? What sorts of things, how can we learn from history about the do's and the don'ts about being an intellectual? But generally speaking, presenting a rather sympathetic portrayal of the intellectual as something that is worth aspiring to, but a kind of role that is full of a lot of challenges and potentially pitfalls. As you know, the intellectual, especially in the English-speaking world, is a rather checkered category. It's not exactly one, unlike, let's say, France, Germany, and most of continental Europe, where the intellectual is still regarded with a certain degree of respect. In the English-speaking world, there's always been this kind of suggestion or implication that the intellectual is kind of a dilettante, somebody who sort of ought to be minding his own business rather than nosing around in everybody else's, a sort of troublemaker, ambient troublemaker maybe, and so this is one kind of problem, you might say, sort of public relations problem that the intellectual has in the English-speaking world. But there are also, I think, a more sort of serious kind of issue, which has to do, and this is where sort of I come from on this issue, is whether there is much incentive within academic life to be an intellectual, okay? Because there is an issue about what is the breeding ground for intellectuals, right? As it turns out, at the University of Lund in Sweden this June, I'm going to be teaching a two-week sort of boot camp course based on this book on how to be an intellectual, where graduate students from different countries will come and learn the mysteries of this. The thing that's quite interesting when one puts together a curriculum, as it were, about, okay, the intellectual, which figures are we talking about here? Well, it ends up, right, if you think about the figures, and I'm just going to rattle off some names. So we say, let's say, somebody like Peter Abelard in the 11th century, who was one of the earliest scholastics, a very controversial figure, who was a person who is usually credited with having introduced the dialectical method into theology, where you basically show contradiction between different verses in Scripture. And then you say, well, we're going to have to sort something out, guys, because the Bible doesn't speak in one voice. Right? And then let's say we move a few more centuries. We get somebody like Erasmus, the great Renaissance humanist. And one of the things about Erasmus is basically saying, look, doesn't matter whether you're Protestant or Catholic, neither of your views are backed up by the Bible, that in fact the Bible's talking about something different, and in fact you're going to have to settle your differences some other way, but please don't mystify them by saying there's scriptural source for it. We can go another century or two and we get to somebody like Voltaire. okay, who demystifies church authority in particular, talks about the value of science as a potential replacement for theology, but at the same time is also skeptical about overblown claims about the natural good sense of ordinary human beings, okay? And then we can move into the 19th century, and you might think of somebody like Karl Marx, for example, who was so radical in various ways that he could never actually get an academic career. And you move into the 20th century, and in particular, if we think about this year, 2005, is the 100th anniversary of the birth of two of the second half of the 20th century's most important intellectuals, Raymond Aron and Jean-Paul Sartre. Okay, these are two major French intellectuals of the Cold War era. Sartre maybe is the more well-known still, who is a big supporter of communism, even in its totalitarian forms, long after it was fashionable. And Raymond Aron held the opposing view, was one of the few French supporters of a sort of Anglo-American liberalism in the Cold War era, long before that became fashionable. Okay, so both of them were, in a sense, kind of promoting their views outside of the period of fashion. Now, one of the things, though, I've just given you a sort of list of people and some sort of snapshot of where these guys were coming from. Now, one of the things that all these people have in common is, first of all, what academic discipline do any of them belong to? Right? Which academic discipline will even want to claim them? Okay? I mean, that's one problem we have. Namely, there is a problem here of trying to, you might say, codify the history of the intellectual, because the intellectual seems to pop up in many different kinds of roles, right? And there's no, as it were, the history of the intellectual is not like, let's say, the history of philosophy, and you know, sociologists will know that in the last few years, Randall Collins, the sociologist, has done this book, enormous book, called The Sociology of Philosophy. It's 1,000 pages long, and one of the things that's very striking about the book is you can tell a very coherent history of philosophy that includes just about everybody you'd normally call a philosopher by looking at networks of association, usually, you know, sort of teacher-pupil relations, but also correspondent relations. So there is a kind of institutionalized history, right, that you can say of philosophers, and certainly of scientists, right? You're not a physicist unless you study with a physicist kind of thing, right? And so there's a very coherent history there, too. But if you're going to do a history of the intellectual, right, then it's not so clear, is there a coherent history? Because these people I've just named, right, relate to various disciplines in various ways, and typically in a very checkered fashion, right? In other words, they're not exactly unequivocal good guys, right? They're controversial even today, right, about what exactly their contributions were. I mean, to be sure, they are remembered as memorable figures, as exciting figures, you know, as intellectually challenging figures, and maybe even historically important figures in the sense that in their day, somebody like this had to come along. But once they're gone, what's the legacy? Right? Is there some body of knowledge, let's say, which is usually kind of the way in which when we talk about value in intellectual life, we talk about contributions to bodies of knowledge. That's the normal way of thinking about this. And in that respect, it's not clear what intellectuals do in this, how they function in this kind of way of thinking. And so this is one of the things that makes it, in fact, very difficult. If one, let's say, wants to teach a course on how to be an intellectual, it's not like how to be a scientist or how to be a philosopher, where you've got some clear lineages, right, of even teacher-student relations that one can fall back on. Right here, one is talking about, you know, a certain kind of studied, you might say, opposition or contrarianness with various institutional arrangements in one's day. So, you know, Abelard and Erasmus and Voltaire, to take just those three together, had very strange relationships with philosophy and theology. Okay, which always kind of put them in a very, very difficult situation, sometimes even threatening their lives. Okay, so that's one thing. There's a sense in which intellectuals are the sort of people who may, in fact, be quite active and prominent and notable in their day, but once they're gone, and even if we think about people like Sartre and Aron, you know, both of whom, you know, died within the last quarter century, okay, where are they studied today? I mean, their significance, you know, as soon as they disappear, they drop off. I mean, a good American example of this is John Dewey, who is, of course, a very important pragmatist philosopher, But when he died in 1952, after having been the most prominent philosopher in the United States for at least a couple of generations, he lived to be 93 years old after all, he just dropped off the map. Same thing is true of Bertrand Russell in Britain. Very important in his day. When he died, nobody talks about it. Okay? Now, of course, there have been some, you know, those of you who follow philosophy know there's been some revival of both of these figures in a very modest kind of way, but nothing approaching the kind of dominance they had in public intellectual life during their lifetime. In other words, that effect does not let, there's not this kind of long half-life. I mean, people like, for example, Kant became more important when they died, and as time went on, gained greater and greater influence over time. Kant, after all, was teaching in Königsberg, which was often East Prussia in the middle of nowhere, and yet, you know, once he died, his fame really rose. And this is a very common pattern, actually, in philosophy, where there's a tendency for the effects to get sort of more pronounced over time as people get more followers, more students, more people doing exegesis, following up their work in various ways, and so forth. But intellectuals, almost the exact opposite happened. They're sort of important as long as they're there pushing the ideas in the various forms in which they push them. And then once they go, right, the ideas are what they stood for go. I mean, people may know of the name, but the name doesn't mean anything. So if I say somebody, you know, if I say Erasmus or Voltaire, you say, yeah, I sort of know who this guy is. You know, I kind of heard of him. But why? What did he do? What's his importance? You see, that's the thing. That's a very interesting feature about intellectuals, is this. And it's one of the things that, in a way, you know, if you're training to be an academic, right, in a way that starts to ring the alarm bells about what's going on here. Because when you're training to be an academic, right, you're training to be an authority in a certain kind of body of knowledge. And primarily for purposes of promulgating and transmitting that body of knowledge. So in a sense, right, you're presenting yourself as a vehicle. Okay. One of the things in contrast that's quite interesting about intellectuals is intellectuals are always kind of personalities. Right? I mean, in fact, the thing that in a sense sort of survives, you might say, the longest about an intellectual is their personality. So one thinks about Erasmus as being this very witty, wry kind of guy, you know. Voltaire, sort of similar kind of image, right? There's this kind of aftertaste or aroma of the guy, but there's not much of the content. Okay? Now that's the exact opposite of what academics are supposed to be transmitting content, perhaps adding to content, but are themselves not supposed to be part of the issue. Okay? And Thomas Kuhn, for example, in his account of science, talks about normal science, right? This is what normal science is all about, right? Where you're laboring under a paradigm. The paradigm provides the overarching conceptual framework, and there you are solving kind of particular problem. And if your name becomes known at all, it's because of a law or a finding or a discovery of a factoid, as it were, that's attached to your name, but not because of your total personality that was operating in many different forms in many different contexts and so forth. Okay, so the sense in which to be an academic and to be an intellectual really quite different kinds of things from the standpoint of the sorts of discipline that is being required of you. Okay, now this, you know, brings us to a very kind of touchy issue, I think, with regard to the relationship between academics and intellectuals, and that is ideas, right? If nothing else, intellectuals are about ideas, right? And they're about arguing about ideas, promoting ideas, whatever. Now, are academics about ideas? Right? What is exactly the relationship there? Now, one of the things that's quite interesting about the sort of people that I identified as intellectuals, and Karl Marx, not the least, okay, because in a way Karl Marx is probably the one who's in a sense the most academically studied of all these people I named, is that they operated in multiple media. Okay. In other words, one of the consequences of their not being restricted to a particular academic discipline is that they were not restricted to a particular mode of expression. Right? They were not just writing for peer-reviewed journals, as we say this day. You know, sort of gold standard of academic life is to be published in the peer-reviewed journals. Right? The guys, if they did that at all, you know, assuming such things existed when they lived, that wasn't all they did, and was probably not primarily what they did. Right, they were operating at many different media. Now, one has to understand media in a very, you know, nowadays, of course, with our high-tech age, we tend to think about media like radio, television, internet, etc. But one should also think about media, I think, in terms of different linguistic registers, right? So one just doesn't write the technical article, but one also writes the popular book, or one writes popular verse even, or one writes plays, in the case of Jean-Paul Sartre. One writes newspaper articles. One gives speeches, right? All these kinds of things. And so one operates in multiple media. Now, why do you operate in multiple media? Well, because at the end of the day, what you're committed to is not the form of expression, but what's being expressed. And if something really is an idea, right, then there's a sense in which it should always be able to transcend any particular form of expression. It should always be able to be put in other words. Okay? Otherwise, it is tied to the form of expression. And this is where some of the conflict between intellectuals and academics come from. Because academics, to a large extent, derive their authority from the particular forms of expression that they use. Right? The technical jargon is the most obvious one, right? Even in the form of teaching, right? Where one, in a sense, I mean, this is certainly true of people who are sort of beginner teachers, right? There's a tendency, you know, the way I'm going to sort of domesticate the class is going to be by being very technical, and so if they don't know what I'm talking about, they'll be cowed into listening more carefully, right? Because they might think they're missing something. Okay? Whereas if I were to actually say what I'm talking about in more accessible terms, then you know, they might figure out what I mean and it might start questioning me. I might not be able to answer their questions. But this whole business of posing and answering questions, that is the substance of intellectual life, according to an intellectual. In other words, the intellectual, by dealing with ideas in this sort of multimedia fashion, right, where he could talk about them in all sorts of registers, all sorts of media, right, is encouraging people to question, encouraging people to respond, right, encouraging some kind of even challenge to the authority, because that's the function of the intellectual, okay? But that's not necessarily the function of the academic, okay? Of course, some academics may see themselves in this light, and I don't want to say that being an intellectual and being an academic are mutually exclusive categories. They're partially overlapping, but only partially overlapping, okay? And to a large extent, what distinguishes the academic is the command over a body of knowledge, which is typically demonstrated in the presence of peers, that is to say, other people who are equally in command of that language in the same way. It is not demonstrated by being able to convince or persuade many different types of people of what you're saying. Okay, so it's a totally different market, you might say, for communication going on here. Now, I think this is quite an important point in terms of the way in which we think about intellectual life today and what's happening to it. Because certainly in Britain, and of course this has been true in America, there is a lot of discussion about the phenomena of dumbing down, right? And when one talks about the decline of intellectual life or the purported decline of intellectual life, often this expression gets conjured up, and next week in Warwick, where I teach in Britain, I'm going to be having a debate with a guy named Frank Faridi, and it's on the topic of my talk today. In fact, this is why I chose this topic, because it's the topic of the debate, namely, is the public intellectual an endangered species? And he believes that it is, because we live in a culture of dumbing down. Faridi believes this. Okay, I believe that the intellectual is an endangered species, perhaps, but not because of dumbing down. For me, what gets called dumbing down is the recognition that, in fact, intellectual life is decreasingly conducted in print media, and especially technical print media. So in other words, dumbing down is a migration phenomenon. Namely, right, ideas are being transacted in places other than, you know, academic texts. They're being transacted on TV, radio, right, in newspapers, and lots of, and this gets called dumbing down because in a sense in which the media are no longer, intellectual life is no longer contained to specific media. It's diffuse. And the diffuse is what's being registered as dumbing down, the diffuseness. And that has a lot to do with more people participating in it. And so when, you know, look in the internet, look at the blog phenomena, right, that's a great example of the sort of thing I'm talking about here, where you have, in fact, people actually making, you know, if one wants to spend the trouble reading these things, right, making often very interesting salient kinds of points, okay, but not necessarily in the academically prescribed manner, right, And very often people complain, look at all these people going on the internet and just saying whatever they think. You know, it's just creating chaos and confusion and information explosion and all the rest of it. Well, no, it's enriching intellectual life, but what it's doing is it's decentering it from sort of the traditional seats of academic authority. Okay? And that's at least how I would see what people call dumbing down is that. That's what I think is going on under what other people would call dumbing down. But where I do think intellectual life is potentially endangered is with regards to its future in academia. Okay? That's a different question. And this has to do with issues that I've already been foregrounding, namely, there isn't really that much of an incentive within academia to actually be an intellectual in the full-blown sense of the guys that I was mentioning at the beginning of the talk, Abelard, Erasmus, Voltaire, etc. Okay? And the reasons are perfectly obvious to anyone who pursues an academic career. In the first instance, there is the business about where you publish, right? And the really blue chip publishing is with the most elite academic peer reviewed journals in your discipline. Okay, that's the first point. Now that moves it way away from public intellectual life right there. And that's really, and in fact, there are some places where if you, in fact, do something else, like publish in newspapers or magazines or those kinds of forums, that actually could be held against you, especially if you're not tenured. Okay? So there's that problem. But even on the teaching front, because the teaching, from the standpoint of ordinary academic careers, teaching is traditionally the place where the academic is best positioned to make a contribution to public intellectual life, the classroom. Because here you are with these students, right, who are going to be the civic leaders of tomorrow, right? And here you have an opportunity to impart to them, who most of whom are not going to be specialists in your field, what is important about your field they should know and take with them in whatever field they end up going into. Okay? So that is kind of the perfect rhetorical setting for the public intellectual, the classroom. That's the way it should be. And sometimes it is, in fact. Sometimes it is. However, again, when we think about what is, you know, within the value structure of academia, the really valued teaching in academia is graduate teaching and PhD supervision. And the people who are really on top of their game from the teaching standpoint are engaged in the most elite form of teaching, where what, in fact, you're doing is reproducing people who are kind of dealing in the technicalities that you're dealing with when you're working in your most professionalized frame. Okay? And so again, the value structure pulls you away from the public intellectual side. In fact, where I live in Britain, for example, this is even a financial proposition because it costs a lot more money to pursue a PhD than to pursue an undergraduate degree, and so the more PhD students you bring in, right, the richer your department becomes. So there's even a financial side to this, as well as a sort of prestige side. Okay? And all of this sort of militates against public intellectual life. And add to this the fact that it's not easy to publish in peer-reviewed journals. The fact that it's even if you're a specialist in your field, it doesn't follow that it's therefore easy to get into these. So you're going to be spending all your time basically trying to get into these journals. And you'll spend your whole career doing it. Okay? And the same thing with trying to keep up your game so you're able to supervise PhD students effectively. So from that standpoint then, right, intellectual life sort of gets evacuated from academia. Now one place where this has happened a lot, and in fact the vanguard of this kind of movement, has been in the natural sciences. And this has had a very interesting kind of effect. The way in which it works in the natural sciences, of course, is that the way the research frontiers develop, right, things get more specialized over time. And that basically, unless you're really focused on a particular specialty and you're really on, you know, you're really one of the, you know, whatever, 5 or 10 key labs or whatever working in this area, you're really not part of the game, right? And so the question is going to be getting to the center of the action and staying there as long as possible, given that it's so volatile, right, and there's so few players who can really get themselves involved in it. So what happens is that a lot of people who go into the sciences because they've been inspired, let's say, by, you know, Einstein or Maxwell or something like that, you know, these guys with these great big pictures of the cosmology and all that, right, they end up realizing that, in fact, if they're going to do physics, they're going to be working on some very specialized stuff very quickly and just be focused on that exclusively, right, say, this is not for me. So they quit after the bachelor's degree or maybe the master's degree. And what they do is, and this is the phenomenon that we've seen very much in Britain, is they go into science communication. Okay? And in fact, this is a sort of burgeoning area in Britain. And it's actually had a very interesting kind of salutary effect, because what it's done is it's begun to create a very strong public intellectual culture for the natural sciences in Britain. Basically, all those people who went into the natural sciences because they had the big vision, like the 19th century guys did, okay, but realized once they got through the first degree that it was going to be this very boring, technical, specialized stuff, they decided this wasn't for them, but they didn't give up the dream, as it were. They figured the way they were going to, in fact, express it and develop it was going to be by engaging in this more generalized activity, which may involve writing popular science books, doing science journalism. Some people even do science PR, right, given all these science parks and all these companies, startup companies and things like that involving science today. And so there's now master's and PhD programs developing in Britain and other countries, of course. There are some in America as well, focusing on science communication, picking up all these people, these disenchanted people who kind of came into science for public intellectual reasons, but then got turned off once they saw what the research frontier was like, and now they move into this other area. And so last year in Britain, Prospect Magazine, which is a kind of a, it's a bit like the American Prospect, a magazine called the American Prospect in this country, did a poll of Britain's top 100 intellectuals, and number one was Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins, who wrote the book Selfish Gene, who's an evolutionary biologist, and that wasn't surprising. That wasn't surprising. If you live in Britain, it's not surprising. He's in the newspapers all the time. He's writing all these articles. I mean, he was one of the first guys, you know, to give an evolutionary explanation of 9/11. I'm not going to go through it. It was rubbish. But it's interesting because he was actually trying to, you know, as it were, hook up, you know, this kind of big science picture with these very immediate kind of events, which is a very kind of, you know, public intellectual thing to do. Whether you like what he ends up doing is another matter, but the fact that he's doing it and it gets some sort of serious recognition is quite significant. And indeed, of the top 10, I would say at least 4 or 5 were proper scientists in this list of the top 100. Okay. And one of the things that came up in the discussion of this poll, and it was very interesting because it may not have crossed your mind, was, okay, why are all these natural scientists in the poll, and why weren't there more proper humanists or especially social scientists? Because of course there'd be journalists and there'd be novelists and poets and, you know, people who are professional writers, but those shouldn't be confused with academic humanists. Right, who teach English and philosophy and those subjects, right? And there were very few of those guys on the list. There were lots of writers, but very few of the academic humanists, and hardly any social scientists. Okay, and so there's the issue of why you get these natural scientists, but you then don't get so many of these other kinds of people in academia. And one of the things that I think is very important here is the issue of the multimedia side of this. So, for example, one of the things that natural scientists are very good at, Dawkins is very good at this, and even ordinary natural scientists can be very good at this, and that is being able to express whatever they have to talk about in whatever size or shape is demanded of them. Okay, so for example, right, they're masters of the PowerPoint when they need to be. They can use the overhead projector. They can speak off the cuff in a radio program about what they're doing. They can target for all different kinds of audiences. And very often, I mean, in the case of Britain, where this is very noticeable, it's often because their funding depends on it. I mean, I think the fact that the natural scientists are so articulate in so many different media in Britain has a lot to do with the fact that funding for natural science in Britain is poorly institutionalized by world standards. In other words, Britain is, you know, if you look at what are the major scientific countries of the world, you think about the United States, Britain, Germany, France, Japan, okay? Britain is the last one by far to actually have a national funding council for the natural sciences. I mean, it's always been a kind of, you know, sort of always kind of begging mode has been very common in Britain, and that's why Britain has so many institutions like the Royal Society, the Royal Institution, the British Association for the Advancement of Science, which are all basically public relations bodies to encourage people to like science and make contributions to it. That's what all these bodies are really about. And you publicize what scientists are doing in the hope that the government or somebody will give you more money. And that's where all these wonderful lectures that were given during the Victorian period was about. It was about supporting science, getting philanthropists on board. Okay? And so you become very good and very skilled at this kind of thing. Now, the problem with the humanists and the social scientists, by contrast, is that a lot of their authority is very much tied to the media in which they normally operate. And that is usually, that's the words. That is the words. That's the text. I mean, and, you know, this stuff always comes back to haunt us in the humanities and social sciences. Namely, you know, when some smart-ass student or some smart-ass journalist, for that matter, says, look, when we strip the jargon off this stuff that you're talking about, aren't you just saying something pretty commonsensical? Or aren't you saying, even if it's not commonsensical, can't it be said more simply, you know, or expressed more plainly, and perhaps then we might see the problems with it, you know? And there is a large grain of truth to this. This is what I would like to say, namely, that there is a sense in which the academic authority, right, of our field, humanities and social sciences, is very much tied to a certain kind of verbal medium, which if it's not present, if you're not forced to transact ideas in that medium, does cause considerable problems. Okay? Now, I don't think this is a necessary failure. In other words, I don't think this is like, as it were, some fatal flaw that shows, you know, natural sciences are definitely conveying ideas, whereas humanities and social sciences are conveying just words. I'm not saying that. Okay, because it is in fact possible, as we know this, I mean, this is in fact one of the things about media studies and cultural studies is in fact quite good, is the fact that, one can use one's imagination and think about how ideas can be conveyed in different kinds of media, and one doesn't just have to rely on the technical terms. I'll give you an example of where this in fact worked very effectively very recently in television. I don't know if this has been shown yet in America. If it is shown in America, it'll probably be shown on PBS. But in Britain last year, there was a three-part documentary called The Power of Nightmares. And it was by a British independent film director, Adam Curtis, who happens to have a PPE degree from Oxford. That is to say, philosophy, politics, and economics. In Oxford and Cambridge, still, you can't just get a straight philosophy degree. It has to be combined with other disciplines. And what is this about? Well, this is basically about showing the parallel tracks from the end of World War II to the present day between, on the one hand, the intellectual trajectory of Islamic fundamentalism, and on the other hand, the intellectual trajectory of American neoconservatism. And to basically show kind of almost like one-to-one mapping. Okay? And so on the one hand, on the Islamic fundamentalist side, one is talking about the ideas of Said Qutbi, who is this Egyptian fundamentalist who is this big thorn in the side for Nasser in the 1950s and got put in prison and is kind of one of the intellectual spiritual leaders of a lot of the Al-Qaeda stuff that's going on. And on the neoconservative side, it's about Leo Strauss and all of his progeny at the University of Chicago. Okay? And so the document... Now, the thing that's interesting is that's the premise of the documentary. You might think, God, this is going to be, how are you going to do this? This is just like all abstractions chasing abstractions with these guys, right? You know, if you know anything about these people, you know that, first of all, they're not really writing about what was happening in 9/11, but they're writing about something else that then other people sort of allegorically interpret as being of some relevance. So how are you going to represent that on film in some kind of compelling manner? Well, I'm not going to tell you how he did. I would just invite you, if you get a chance to see it. I mean, you can go to the, you can perhaps go to the BBC website and get some snippets of it. But the point is, it can be done. It was very effective, and in fact, it got enormous praise, even won awards as film documentary in conveying these very abstract ideas, right? That go back to, you know, ancient Islamic philosophy and Platonism in the West, and presenting them visually very well, very often by using visual clips that were in fact about something else originally, but then using them symbolically against a sort of voiceover that was making sense of them. So all of a sudden, you know, it started to mean something different when you heard the words in connection with the pictures. And it worked really well. It worked really well. Okay, it won awards. But it's a great example of, you know, taking a very sort of very much heartland humanistic topic, right, which you could imagine as a topic for a book or a PhD or something like that, following the parallel currents between recent Islamic fundamentalism and the sort of American neoconservatism, and putting it on film. And it takes a certain amount of ingenuity, certain kind of imagination, but it does work and it can be done. But obviously, there has to be a kind of incentive for proceeding in this manner, right? And this is what I think is kind of lacking at the moment in academic culture, with regard to both how students are trained and also how academics are professionally rewarded, so that one doesn't sort of get inspired, as it were, to move in these directions. Okay, you know, some of you may remember, those of you old enough may remember from when I was a kid, The Ascent of Man, which was one of the original BBC Two documentaries with Jacob Bronowski, which tried to do this kind of very philosophical history of humanity's self-realization, rising from the animals and realizing what its purpose is and so forth. It's recently come out in DVD. And I've had a chance to kind of look at that again. How exactly did that work? How exactly does one work with the film to get across some very abstract ideas? And, you know, you start to notice things like about Bernofsky's dramatic presence and the way he's able to use his hands even to be able to convey certain kinds of ideas that if you actually were to write them down and spell out what's actually being captured could be quite complicated, but could be captured quite effectively by someone who knows how to act. And in fact, this is one of the things that Richard Attenborough, who was the director of this series, his little interview with him, this is what he says about Bronowski. The man was a great actor. He could take like these very abstract things and just with a few gestures kind of convey the sense of them. Well, what I'm saying here is that this is, if one wants to talk about how humanists and social scientists can contribute to public intellectual life in a way that's comparable to what I think natural scientists have been able to accomplished so far, but this is the kind of stuff that they have to kind of take more seriously, and it's in other words, we should be moving away from the usual kinds of complaints about dumbing down, where we're saying things like people aren't reading enough books, right? You know, you think about what the dumbing down argument boils down to: people don't read books, they have short attention spans, right? They don't care about anything important anymore. You know, they're just concerned about their own provincial, parochial activities. All these complaints that are associated with dumbing down, I think, are totally misguided. But rather, the failure lies with us in terms of our own very narrow conception as academics of what intellectual life is. Okay, and this is where I think the development needs to occur. All right. Now, I think the big challenge in all this, and I will end on this point, and it's a point that comes up at the very end of my book on the intellectual, has to do with the difficulty that I think is always going to be facing intellectuals, even when they are able to be media savvy, you might say, in the ways that I've been talking about so far. And that has to do with the problem of representing collective memory, okay? In other words, how do you convince the current generation? Because in a sense, I think if you're a public intellectual, your ultimate audience is going to be the people who are going to be taking whatever ideas are being put forward into the future. So there's a sense in which your ultimate audience is always the young. It always ultimately ought to be the younger people. Okay, but the problem with the younger people is that they don't have much historical memory or even historical knowledge. And it's not because they're not reading books or anything. And in part, it has a lot to do with their not having been around very long to find out very much about anything. Okay? And it seems to me that is the real kind of challenge, and in particular, a challenge, you know, that will then need to be met in these rather constrained media in which we're always being forced to operate. I mean, so for example, one of the things that I found very striking looking at The Ascent of Man again, now 30 years later, right, and watching Bernofsky, okay, I was very impressed with this when I saw it the first time around, and I was very impressed with it the second time around. But at the same time, I thought, wow, this is very dated in a way. The sorts of things that he's saying, that he's trying to say to become accessible. You know, if I were to show this to my class today, because Bernofsky's thing is very impressive in one sense, and you're very tempted to sort of use this in the classroom to sort of say, okay, here's an argument for how we become human beings rising up from the animals, a very sophisticated kind of argument that's presented very artfully in a documentary format. One of the problems is going to be the students cannot catch the references, the taken for granted aspects of things. So for example, he mentions B.F. Skinner. Okay? I hope you people know who B.F. Skinner was. When I was a kid, he was a big deal. Okay? He stood for something, right? In a sense, you know, by mentioning his name, you know, in a sense, you kind of got a sense of, okay, he was like as important as Freud, I would say, when I was a kid, in terms of, you know, marking something, in terms of the nature of the mind and so forth. But it wouldn't have that resonance today. And so there would be a lot of what Bernofsky says that just, you know, would kind of sound like noise. They'd be intrigued. I mean, he has a captivating manner. They would think that he's saying something important. He comes across as a kind of, you know, important guy and, you know, impressive and all that. But it would be difficult to recreate that. Now, you might say, okay, all this is an argument for the role of the intellectual in this sort of general sense needs to always be reinvented for every generation in new ways. And so, in a sense, it's a very benign kind of message. In other words, you'll always have to be making another ascent of man. And in fact, this time you won't call it the ascent of man. Right? But the point is that that's one way of reading it. But then, of course, if one thinks about then, well, what's the point of having done this in the first place? You know, we want to kind of put forward these intellectual ideas. We want to make these urgent points about the nature of humanity or whatever, because we want people to learn from this, and we want people to, as it were, improve themselves and all the rest of it, right? I mean, there is a kind of always an urgency to intellectual life and with the role of the intellectual, but it seems that the long-term trajectory is, you know, it's like Sisyphus, right? You never really make real progress. You just sort of go back to the beginning and then you start again. Okay, and that may, in fact, be the lesson. And so I think this is, in a sense, one of the things that always makes engaging in intellectual life both exhilarating and also ultimately very frustrating, right? Because there is a sense in which, let's say you do hit the mark really well in your day, as Bernofsky did, for example, because that documentary, The Ascent of Man, was recognized as brilliant immediately. And just like this Adam Curtis thing was recognized as brilliant when it came out as well. But then, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, you know, it immediately you realize we couldn't do this today. It wouldn't have the same impact today. We have to reinvent this. We have to do this again. But then what happens to the older versions? They get forgotten, of course, because they don't actually serve that intellectual function anymore. Okay, and this is, in fact, what happened to all these intellectuals that I was mentioning earlier. They sort of get forgotten. They get remembered maybe as a name, but what they stood for is no longer so clear, because if you want to perform the kind of function that those guys were performing in their day, you would not rely on their means. You would not use their arguments, right? You wouldn't say what they were saying, right? You would be saying something quite different to actually recover that role. And so as a result, those guys disappeared. Okay? And I'm of two minds about this, but I do think that if one undertakes the life of the intellectual, this is a possible consequence of engaging in that, namely that you end up just being sort of remembered as a kind of intellectual aroma over the centuries, rather than some sort of substantive, solidified body of knowledge that others might think they're building on. I'll stop here so I can take some questions, since this has been about 45 minutes, and I want to get the audience going here. Derrida, sure.
Mm-hmm. And the different ways in which he became a prominent philosopher in France and the United States, and she's making a structural argument. And to me, that would be, you know, a particularly useful way of looking at some of the dynamics that you're talking about. You know, not to say you didn't mention that in your talk, but I would have given more front
Okay. I think that's a good point. I mean, in the case of Derrida, I mean, this is what he's referring to. It's a sort of general phenomenon, the way that happens to French intellectuals, because, you know, in France, they sort of cycle through, and, you know, for about 5 years, and then the next one comes along, and they're all sort of floating in there, and people, you know, aren't losing their lives, and they're certainly not spending their career studying them the way they do in the United States. Right? French intellectuals become disciplines in the United States. And typically not, you know, these French intellectuals are typically philosophers, but typically not in philosophy departments in the United States, literary theory or maybe sometimes sociology, whatever. I think that's an interesting point. I mean, but you see, somebody like Derrida exists more as an intellectual in France than in America. In America, he exists as a kind of academic philosophical presence, right? You know, part of a lineage that then all of these various, you know, followers and students then institutionalized by writing a lot of texts about him and by training people in this way, and in fact even formalizing his discourse much more than even he himself found comfortable, right? Because Derrida was always complaining that deconstruction is not a method, for example, contrary to what all these Americans are doing, right? And I think there's an interesting issue there, right? Because in France, guys like Derrida and even Foucault, right, existed as intellectuals and as a result, had some of the ephemerality of intellectuals, in the sense that they were fashionable for a while and then not so fashionable afterwards. But in America, they get institutionalized and become solid figures and part of the canon, right? And then the issue about, you know, canonizing intellectuals, this is a difficult thing. And I think in France, you know, I'm a little reluctant to say this, but you might say they have a kind of healthier attitude about these guys, right? They got so many of them. They're not going to get overwhelmed by any one of them. They'll take them seriously for a while, and then they'll move on to the next one. But in America, some people will spend their whole lives being experts on one. Okay? Now, this reflects lots of things. I think one thing that, you know, we haven't spoken about yet in the background here is the financial resources of American universities are much more luxuriant than anything in Europe. And so you actually have the opportunity in America to spend a career specializing in Derrida. I mean, that says something about the level of wealth in the university system that you could get away doing that and, like, run seminars where 5 students are studying Derrida. Okay, in Europe, it's very difficult to do something like that. Okay? And I think that's also part of the equation as well about the institutionalization. You need a certain kind of stable resource base that allows these things to take root long enough. And I think the United States there, yeah, is much superior to Europe in that regard. But again, there is a question about how much institutionalization you really want for these guys. Like, has it, you know, like Lamont, for example, I read her article as not quite cynical, but in a certain way, showing in a way that, you know, this Derrida phenomena is a kind of an emergent effect of the way in which institutionalization happens to happen in the United States, and not necessarily a reflection of the true merit of the guy's work. So I think there is an issue here. There's a kind of a delicate balance, you might say, because certainly we don't want intellectuals just, you know, disappearing as soon as they die. But on the other hand, it's not at all clear we want people spending their whole lives, you know, reproducing their texts and reproducing their ideas as if they were some kind of sacred figure, which we actually do have in the United States. We do have that kind of phenomenon taking place where people call themselves Derrida experts, Foucault experts, you know. So there is a kind of a line here that one needs to tread. Yes, Bob.
You've been talking primarily in terms of communication practices, but another difference is the human writing practice and the human practice. There seems to be a social role for human writing, but it's not as well established, certainly it's not as same social utility. So have you thought about that?
I think one of the things.
Well, in France, you literally say I'm an intellectual. In a way, it's simple now, too.
Right. To a certain extent, if you wanted to do a kind of like a sort of sociological history of the intellectual's social role, an important part of the story, and this is a story that actually, this part of the story is one that, for example, Joseph Schumpeter highlights in Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy, that you end up, you know, when countries reach a certain level of wealth, part of the way they symbolically display the wealth is by increasing their universities, because it shows that they're putting their money into something that's really worth something, and this ends up producing all these academically qualified people, but there's no place for them to go, in a sense. Right, so there are not enough academic jobs for them to filter back into, and so there's sort of, there's a surplus produced. And the surplus, in a way, is kind of ambient and alienated and not quite clearly placed in the means of production. And this is where your intellectual class comes from, basically. The first period where this happened, and this is something Randall Collins talks about in The Sociology of Philosophy, is in what we call the Golden Age of Spanish Literature in the late 16th, early 17th century, where Spain had like 32 universities, and part of this was as a result of all the wealth that was brought back from the New World in the period of exploration, right? And in fact, the number of males who went to university in Spain in the early 17th century would only be matched by Germany and the United States at the end of the 19th century. So it was really big knowledge society moment there. But but the point was there weren't academic jobs or even civil service jobs for all these people to go into. And so what happened was these people basically took the kinds of academic skills that they were learning in university and they applied them to writing for a trade. And this is in fact how Cervantes does Don Quixote as the first novel, which is a kind of a mock scholarly treatise, right, if you recall with the way that book is written. And so the argument is that the novel as a genre emerges as a kind of an effect of somebody who's very academically trained, doesn't actually have an academic job to go to, but still wants, you know, so as it were, puts it in this imaginative medium, okay? And it seems to me this is kind of where, you know, you can sell similar kinds of stories about how various kinds of novels, different forms of literature start to emerge as kind of spillover effects, in a sense. One of the problems, you might say an unintended consequence of the relative wealth of the American scene, is that you don't have this large bunch of unemployed, academically trained people. They're actually, at least historically, there have been academic jobs for these people to go into, and so they very comfortably go into them, okay? And so there isn't that kind of regular surplus. I mean, because it's much harder, it's always been much harder to get a permanent academic post in Europe than in the United States. Okay, and I think that's a kind of an important part of the equation here, you might say that in that respect, intellectual life in the U.S. because of its relative wealth gets recaptured right into the institutional base, and then gets sort of reproduced in a fairly contained manner. I mean, that's not obviously the whole story because there are intellectuals in the United States, but the fact that you're right, it doesn't sort of exist as a kind of recognizable regular role, I think has something to do with that general kind of difference.
Excuse me. I'm wondering if you've seen the show The Family Life on TBS.
No.
It's a 20 or 30 part series. It's got to be at least 10 years old. And it's one of the few, maybe only that I've seen, great examples of a 30-minute or hour special, regular special, in which you get top philosophers sitting down explaining difficult issues very plainly. And it's so refreshing to see it. I'm really interested.
Yeah.
It seems like this is exactly what's going on in the
science. Well, yeah. And it, you know, the thing is it can be done. You know, I think that's, it's just that there is very little incentive.
Yeah.
There's very little incentive for people to engage in this kind of behavior. But it's, of course it's possible to be done. I do think that there's some things about the media conventions, I think, that one always has to attend to. I always find that it's always quite interesting. As you know, if you've ever done any radio or television or anything like that, one thing that these people hate, the people who direct these things, hate if you have notes or have any text. Right? You should just be there live. That goes against the grain, especially in the humanistic cultures, where much more so than in the natural sciences, the humanistic culture, where having the text in front of you, having a finished text in front of you that you're reading, is a kind of gold standard thing, right? Where in a sense, that shows you've done your work, right? We don't want these guys just coming in there and hoofing it, you know, and just sort of talking off the top of their head. We want people with prepared text. I always wonder why this is the case. I mean, this seems, you know, And the amazing thing, of course, is when you get the guy who's written the very carefully prepared text off the text, ask him a slightly question, slightly off what he actually said, he's hopeless. He's like a deer in front of headlights, right? And see, this is very much against the kinds of conventions you need to operate in order to function in the media environment, in the larger television, radio environment. You have to move away from that, of this sort of text-bound thing that, you know, if I don't get it exactly right when I tell you the answer, you know, I'm not saying anything at all, right? I mean, and in fact, that's the main source of frustration, in fact, these media guys have with academics, right? Because, you know, academics are being told, look, you've got 30 seconds to answer my question, Jack. You've got to figure out which nuances you're going to drop, and don't read a text, okay? And it seems to me that that's something of academic culture, especially in the humanistic side, much more so. Because, you know, one part of the thing about the natural sciences, one reason why they're so flexible, I mentioned the business about they have to kind of, you know, sing for their supper issue. But the other issue, too, of course, is that natural scientists, when they think about the contributions that they make to knowledge, they don't primarily think about it as being embodied in the journal article. Right? The journal article, as it were, is a textual representation of what happened in the lab. Right, or what happens out in the field if you're looking at animals or plants or something like that, right? And so, as it were, the journal article isn't the piece of knowledge itself, right? It's just a representation. And just as that could be a representation, something else could be a representation. You see? And humanists aren't like that, right? Humanists, the knowledge product is a text. Okay, and that is a big problem from the standpoint of being able to function in these multiple media. Sure. Hopeless, isn't it? No.
If you can kind of at least gesture towards maybe one or two solutions, let's say.
Yeah. Oh, I'll tell you one thing. It's like a program, right? First of all, I think a move de-escalating credential requirements for academic life would be helpful, okay? Back in the Middle Ages, you needed a master's degree in order to be called a master and be able to teach a subject, not a PhD. A PhD was originally a kind of professional degree, right? Doctor of theology, doctor of law, doctor of medicine. That was the original thing, right? I wish we could scale down, because we're entering into academic culture is, in fact, escalating credentialism, not merely in the sense of requiring that all of society get a BA before they can get a job as a street sweeper. There's that, too. But also within academia itself, in order to be qualified to get a regular academic post, not only do you need a PhD these days, but you need a few years as a postdoc, right? I mean, and that's an innovation that's happened over the course of my academic career, 20 years. That wasn't there when I began, but now it's getting normalized. And so you have to go through so many hoops, so many credentialing stages, right, proving increasing degrees of technical sophistication and relevance to more and more elite peers. Now that's dragging you away from the public mission. So in a sense, we have to kind of scale that down, you know, and for example, hire people even without PhDs who are competent teachers and know their subject to teach, and kind of make it an open question about whether a PhD or these higher degrees are really required for teaching in academic life. That's one thing, and maybe even decrease the number of people getting PhDs and so forth. I think that's one thing to do. The other thing to do that goes along with this is to bring back liberal education, general education, as being an important part of what teaching and is about. And so in other words, the idea that for every academic discipline, right, you have a kind of general education version of the discipline to teach to people who aren't going to be specialists. And where people who are teaching in that subject are forced to come together and think, what is it in my specialty area that in fact is worth students who aren't going to be in it knowing, and putting that into the curriculum. So that's another part of it, too, to sort of bring that public aspect. Because in principle, the classroom should be the ideal medium for cultivating public intellectual life in academia. It is a natural for that, given who the constituency is. But it's not encouraged. And in fact, you know, undergraduate education is getting more majory, right, where you're trying to get students kind of introduced to the more technical areas of your field earlier on. You know, as if the whole point of teaching undergraduates is to recruit more specialists. Okay, I think that's that mentality, by the way, of teaching undergraduates as if you were teaching potential specialists, it's something that happened as the Cold War began to escalate. I wrote this, some of you may know, I wrote this very large book on Thomas Kuhn a few years ago, and I was looking into, because Kuhn's mentor, James Bryan Conant, who hired Kuhn in his first job, was into general education and science. And in fact, Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolution is a book that is the product of having taught general education and science courses at Harvard. And that was Conant's idea, that you know everybody ought to know about science in the new post-World War II era. But then when the Cold War started, really, in the late 1950s with Sputnik, 1957, okay, the National Science Foundation came up with this education initiative called the Pipeline. And the idea was there was a study that was done that Jerome Bruner, the educational psychologist, was very much part of, which was basically saying that you were imagining the Cold War race between the U.S. and the USSR is, in a sense, vicariously fought as a science race. Who's going to get to the moon first, right, all that kind of stuff. Okay, and the problem was that in the case of the United States, there was a leaky pipe, as it were. So students get introduced to science early in the primary or secondary school, but they're not going through and taking it further in the college years, and they're certainly not going to get the master's and the PhDs to become the technicians that are necessary to fight the Cold War. So we have to kind of, we have to stop the leaks and the pipeline so that in fact the students will be funneling through and all the best students will become scientists. So this is what the NSF begins its first education initiatives in 1960 on that premise, okay? And that just kills general education and science altogether, right? Because general education and science was anathema because it created leaky pipes. Students would learn science for purposes of their civic existence, but not, and so they'd learn history and philosophy of science and the social context of science and all that kind of stuff that Kuhn was kind of into, but they wouldn't be interested in becoming technical scientists. And as a result, they would not be contributing to building bombs and all the rest of it. And so this was a problem, which had to be stopped. And so you close the pipeline, and so you encourage, even at the first year level, teaching science in a very narrow technical way as a way of drawing people into the subject very early on. You see, and it's that Cold War mentality that actually got us into this track where we still are. You see, and I'm saying, scale back. You see, these are the kinds of things that I think could be done. And of course, there are other things, too, with regard to how academics get rewarded. I frankly, given what diminishing small percentage of academic journal articles actually get read, let alone cited, I don't see why there's all this great emphasis in encouraging people to publish in peer-reviewed journals as a sort of mark of scholarship. I think it's sheer lunacy. You should in fact encourage people to read, not to write so much, but to read. There's no incentive to read in academia. There's only incentive to write. Okay, so I'm not being funny here. There was a very important report done by the Carnegie Foundation in 1990 called Scholarship Reconsidered. If you ever get a chance, you should have a look at this. And basically, looking at in the United States, universities are divided into these different Carnegie classification categories. I don't know, 9, 12, whatever they are. They go from Ivy League style PhD granting institutions down to your ordinary community college, and there's different types of things. And so the Carnegie Foundation surveyed people at all of these different types of institutions and asked them, what did they consider scholarship? First of all, did they consider scholarship important for their academic life? And of course they all did. But what did they consider? Where was this scholarship manifested? Okay. And only the ones who were actually at the top two levels actually thought it was manifested by publishing in these peer-reviewed, top-of-the-line journal articles, right? Most of the others believed that their scholarship was manifested in their teaching, right? The understanding being that they are reading widely in their field, they may be attending conferences, right, interacting with colleagues in various ways, and then bringing that, to renew the curriculum, right, the new things that need to be taught. And that's where they thought their scholarship was manifested. That's in the most natural way. And they found it very artificial to have to be taught, to have to be told they have to be publishing all the time. Okay? And the Carnegie Foundation basically recommended, quite reasonably, that we need to change the incentive structure and we shouldn't be acting as if every institution has to be behaving like Harvard. Okay? This, I think, is a very important point. A very important point, and that we need to take seriously the fact that the way in which that an important way in which public intellectual life is enriched through academia is by the integration of new material in the curriculum. on a regular basis. And in fact, that is the point at which you actually get this much highly vaunted, you know, unity of teaching and research of the classical university ideal. That's when it comes in. It comes in when this new stuff that you're picking up actually gets channeled into the curriculum and distributed and disseminated to the students in the classroom. Not when you're writing for other peers. That's just elites communicating with each other. Okay? So those would be the kinds of things that I would, that, you know, I would recommend as being the sorts of things to actually turn academia into a forum for public intellectual life. It would be those kinds of issues. I mean, I've been involved with various organizations from Ford Foundation to UNESCO, European Union, because these issues are very much alive now for a few reasons. One of them being the issue of accountability of universities in a period where the state, you know, in Europe, the state has been traditionally the principal funder of universities through taxes. But now that such a large percentage of Europeans go to universities, almost as much as in the United States, you know, 60% figures, right, the tax base isn't going to be able to bear it any longer, and so the state's pulling out, and so people want more direct accountability for the money they're going to have to start paying out now for education in Europe. So what are we trying to evaluate when we evaluate education? You know, what are we evaluating? How do we evaluate universities appropriately? So I've been pushing the public intellectual lifeline, because as you can imagine, there are other ways in which people want to evaluate universities, how much grant money you bring in, how many clients you have, all this other kind of stuff, right? And also there's the issue about the former Soviet republics and revamping their educational systems. What are they going to be like? So there are all these different contexts where there is room for a fundamental reexamination of the intellectual character of academic life. And so that's where sort of I've been intervening. But I have to say, in world terms, the U.S. looks very good. In comparison to other, because the U.S. is financially relatively insulated. So in principle, if you actually had some proper incentives, you'd probably have the resources and money to be able to become public intellectuals. Okay? Whereas with the European countries, you actually have resource problems, as well as all the other kinds of problems.
Sure. I want to do a second question. One of the names that was, in my mind, notably apt is Tony Gibbs. You wouldn't want his name to be apt. And the reason I bring him up is that one of the things that he didn't discuss so much is the connection of the public intellectual to the political sphere.
Yeah.
And Gibbs represents to some measure that in British terms, and the absence of that.
Yeah, very interesting question. I have very mixed feelings personally about this guy Giddens, but I won't dwell on those. I'll talk about the about what I think is kind of sociologically quite interesting about this, which does relate to the business of academics and public intellectual life. For those of you who aren't sociologists, Anthony Giddens is the most successful sociology textbook writer in Britain, and perhaps maybe even the English-speaking world. In fact, he's quite important in terms of having written textbooks that sell well both sides of the Atlantic, which is pretty unusual, because sociology tends to be a very provincialized subject. Different countries have their own sociology, as it were. It's not like physics or economics where you can use the same textbook in every country. And Giddens sort of succeeded, right, and has written lots of these, but he's a social theorist, but he's, I would say, a scholastic, right? He mixes and matches other people's theories and sort of synthesizes them, right? And you could tell from the way the kind of writing the man does is he's primarily teacher. He's not a guy who's done a lot of empirical research in his career. He's not one of those guys who got big grants or anything like that. And this fits kind of a certain profile of British academics who sort of come of age in the late 70s, early 80s in terms of their careers, because that's the period when the Labour Party gets kicked out of power in Britain and you get Thatcher. And you see, when Labour was in power under Wilson, that was a great period for empirical research in British sociology. And there's a lot of that being done. A lot of surveys of class mobility, all this kind of stuff. And then when Thatcher comes in, all this stuff gets killed, and sociology becomes primarily a teaching subject. It earns its income largely, and this is where cultural studies and media studies and things like this really start to, because they're very popular with students and they can lead to jobs and all the rest of it. And so sociology becomes very much that kind of subject, and Giddens is part of that. Okay. Now, one of the advantages of that, of being, as it were, a subject that, you know, he's primarily a teacher, is he's a very good communicator. I mean, that's one thing about Anthony Giddens. He's a very good communicator. He doesn't just write the textbooks. He knows the you know, he could speak it. I did my MPhil at Cambridge in 1979, and Giddens was then giving as a kind of lecture, undergraduate lecture in the Faculty of Social and Political Studies, because there's no sociology department. The book that became The Central Problems of Social Theory, that book he was giving as a set of lectures. And I attended some of those. And you know, so he had this big audience of multidisciplinary people, and he's giving these things. Now, it's very easy from that standpoint, you know, where you're giving the big picture about society and everything, to then transition your way into what he became eventually, which was kind of a counselor to politicians, right, especially Blair with the Third Way, okay? Because he's always this kind of communicator. This was his sociology. It was a sociology that really was manifesting itself through the transmission of knowledge. So in that sense, he fits very much kind of one way in which an academic can actually function in public intellectual life, through this teaching mode, which is, because so what he did was, for Blair, is he ran a lot of seminars for Blair and brought a lot of Blair's advisors in and told them about the Third Way and how you can sort of walk the fine line, you know, between the neoliberals and the socialists. And you know, that's kind of what he did. That's how he became very influential with Blair, especially in the early part of Blair's government. So it's a kind of success story, right? But it's a kind of success story that the background structural condition was the weakening of sociology as a research subject in Britain. Okay, and as it were, the whole focus changes from the empirical research side to the teaching side. The other thing I think that helps Blair, is that Blair is very, I mean, excuse me, to help Giddens, not to confuse the two guys, is that Giddens is very non-ideological. So unlike a lot of sociologists, let's say, from the 60s and 70s, these kind of more Marxist guys that you may have heard of in Britain, Giddens didn't have any clear ideological colors going into the new labor scene. He was never a critic. Okay, because sociologists, especially in the 60s and 70s, both in America and in Britain, were seen as these critical, quasi-Marxist kind of guys who were always kind of discontented with everything. But Giddens was never part of that scene. So that also helped him kind of move into this when the Labour Party decided to de-socialize itself, right, and to sort of try to pick up some of Thatcher's colors. Giddens was kind of well-positioned to do that as well, because he hadn't nailed his ideological colors to any mast yet, okay, the way some of the other guys had. So there's all that going on. But that's the sort of the Giddens story, and it's a very unique story, actually. There's not really a successor in Britain to him. And as you know, he retired as the director of the London School of Economics, and he recently became a lord.
Well, like to thank you.
Thank you.